around like a piece of gold. I've been bought and I've been sold, feeling not so special now.
Hey, hey, everybody out there. My name is Danny Bedrosian, and welcome to the very first episode of Danny on Everything, my brand new show where I talk about everything from music to history, comedy, movies, culture, politics, comic books, poetry, literature, whatever you got, we're talking about it. My name is Danny Bedrosian. As I said, I'm very happy to be on this new show on Moose Magnificat, where I can shamelessly promote my many albums and also talk to all my different friends from all over the world who do many different fascinating things. I've been wanting to do something like this for a really, really, really long time, and the people at Moose Magnificat were able to allow me to do this, and I hope that this is the beginning of many, many broadcasts, many shows, and we've got a lot of really great stuff lined up for you guys in the future, including on this show, a fantastic interview with Professor Michael Bakken. Michael, besides being a dear friend of mine, is ethnomusicology professor at FSU and has been for many, many years, has written several books, has a couple of new books coming out, and a bunch of new shows coming up, as well as some projects that he's going to tell us about that he's been working on as well. Absolute pleasure to have him on the show. And as I said before, a shameless self-promotion. I have a new album that just came out. My band, Danny Bedrosian and the Secret Army. The album is called Eightfinity, and I thought it would be apropos to start the show with one of those songs. It is track 4 from the album. It is called Rehearse This, and it features, in addition to myself on keys, the great Mr. George Clinton on the vocals, as well as Mr. Stephen Boyd on vocals, fantastic singer from Parliament Funkadelic, The Five Special, Spinners, Dramatics, a number of different groups, Dennis Edwards, Temptations, and a number of different groups, Stephen Boyd, the great Michael Kid Funkadelic Hampton on guitar, as well as some of the lyrics written by my fellow keyboardist Jerome Rogers, and bass by Mr. Dwayne Dungy, fabulous musician and engineer, and drums by Mr. Daryl Spielman, fantastic drummer from the Miami area. And that song is called Rehearse This. And let's check that out right now.
Ain't no reason to rehearse this. We already know this. But this movie don't miss. Do this. Oh, you and me. We already know this.
As our first guest on the show, Professor Michael Bakken. Michael is professor of ethnomusicology and head of the World Music Ensembles program at FSU, Florida State University. He's also the director of the university's Balinese Gamelan Ensemble. He graduated with a PhD from in ethnomusicology, right, from the University of California, Los Angeles, and has performed with such greats as John Cage, Tito Puente, the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, as well as many, many others. Has spoken as a guest lecturer at Harvard and Yale, Columbia, Berkeley, the State University of Rio de Janeiro, and the University of Music in Graz, Austria, as well. Michael, we're so glad to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
So to start at the very beginning, tell us a little bit about where you came from originally and what your roots are.
All right. So I was born in East Lansing, Michigan. My parents both taught at Michigan State University, so I came out of a kind of an academic environment and became involved in music at about 3 years old when I got my first Beatles record, Beatles 6 with 8 days a week and all that kind of stuff. And I used to just, you know, bang around on pots and pans in the kitchen and so on and so forth. And then one day my parents were at the Junior League thrift shop and they saw this box of junk in it. And my mom thought it was pots and pans. And my dad said, no, that's a drum. And so they bought the drum and they brought it home. And there was a kid down the street who was a guitar player. So they figured he'd know how to put together a drum. And so he put it together. Turns out, just by coincidence, that that guy is a guy named Marty Rokich, who's now also a music professor, a composer out in California. Anyway, so he put together the drum, and then I had a little plastic guitar and a Sgt. Pepper suit, and I'd just go down in the basement and spend my days, you know, banging away on the drum, playing on the guitar, and thinking I was the fifth Beatle. So that was really the beginning. And then when I was about six, my sister had taken up the violin, and then she had given it up quickly, and there was this little half-size violin in the hallway, and I felt sorry for the violin, so I thought it needed a friend, so I started playing the violin. So I did violin and drums for a long time. Then when I was 9, started playing my brother's rock band. When I was 11, got into playing jazz, taking lessons, getting a little more serious, and then my mind was blown when I was 11 and my drum teacher told me, oh, there's this concert, you know, jazz concert, you might find it interesting. Turned out it was a double bill of Weather Report and Billy Cobham.
Oh, very nice.
And so that was my total sort of conversion experience. And once I heard Billy Cobham, I'm like, okay, that's the goal right there.
Right.
And, you know, kind of interesting coincidentally that it was Billy Cobham who sort of explored so many interesting things with, you know, Indian rhythmic systems and world music kinds of ideas through Mahavishnu Orchestra and things like
right.
that. And then eventually, much later, well, not that much later, I mean, when I was 15 is when I started getting into some of the West African music and gamelan and things like that. And then eventually went through, got my degree in percussion performance at the University of Toronto. But my teacher there, Russell Hartenberger, was also an ethnomusicologist, great percussionist with Nexus and the Steve Reich Ensemble. But he had also studied South Indian music and done a dissertation on that, did a lot of West African music. And so I got into all that kind of stuff. And then sort of the sad part of the story is when I was in my early 20s, I lost the use of my arms, had a very bad chronic pain condition, and kind of had to give up playing for a while. And that's when I kind of shifted gears and ended up, you know, going to graduate school in ethnomusicology. And as it turned out, that worked out pretty well for me.
I'm sure many people are very thankful for that turn of bad luck.
Yeah, yeah.
So what brought you to Florida State specifically? Was there something about that university that that directed you there?
Yeah, a job.
Yeah, right. Nice.
I didn't know a whole lot about Florida State. You know, I was when I finished my PhD at UCLA, I was lucky enough to move straight into a teaching position at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. But that was a one-year position. It was sort of a temporary thing. Somebody had left at the last minute and I walked into that. They needed somebody who could teach ethnomusicology and direct a Balinese gamelan, so I seized that opportunity. But then, you know, it wasn't clear whether that was going to turn into a permanent position, so meanwhile I was out, you know, applying for everything in the world. So I applied for positions, you know, I applied and actually got interviews at Harvard, at Pomona College out in California, at Wayne State in Detroit. Mm. And then eventually the Bowling Green job did go tenure track and I did get offered the position. But by that time, I had already, you know, gone on the rails for the Florida State job. And once I came down here and checked out what was happening, they had the great ethnomusicologist Dale Olson was here and he was very cool and, you know, very, very friendly. And I thought this would be a great place to be. And I also wanted to live where it was warm.
Right.
But the great thing for me was that so I was kind of kept on the hooks with Harvard. Their search kept sort of dragging on and on. And they were sort of like, well, yeah, you're still under consideration. And finally, you know, after being kind of put on hold for a long time, they offered me the job the day of my interview at Florida State. So I had the great pleasure of being able to call the folks at Harvard and saying, eh, no thanks. So that's how I came here.
Very nice.
Yeah. And, you know, also I had heard, you know, that Florida State was known for two things that I knew about. One, they had a very good football team. Then they had one of kick-ass college of music. And,
okay.
And so that was, yeah, was yeah. very attractive.
For
yeah.
sure. Yeah. Now, I was as I tour for a living, as you know, I was in Bali. We're talking about the Balinese
yep.
gamelan ensemble.
Yeah.
And Upon already knowing your lengthy resume in the past, I already knew that you had already published a great book on the history of Balinese music, about
right.
the you know, traditions of Balinese
Gamelan music.
Yeah. It's called the, so I get it right, Music of Death and New Creation, Experiences in the World of Balinese Gamelan, Balaganjor?
Actually, that was pretty good.
Hey! Which was put out by University of Chicago Press in 1999. That's
right.
Your first...
That was my first book.
Publication, first book. Now, I went to Bali for my first time just a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And just like I thought, whenever I mentioned your name, people in the music industry knew exactly who you were and who I was talking about. Uh-huh. I said, oh, yes, of course we know Michael Backe.
Yeah.
Michael Backe is a big deal and da 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 da. And I was
funny.
Really proud to know you, and I had
wow.
I had played them the rendition that we had done of George Clinton's Atomic Dog
yeah.
with the Balinese Gamelan Ensemble, which was a great connecting point since I was there with George
yeah.
playing
yeah.
in Bali, and they were so proud and happy to know that there was some connection with this American
yeah.
artist.
Yeah.
I want you to tell us about your connection to Balinese culture
right.
and what really initially attracted. I know that you said you got into FSU. They had the Balinese Gamelan program already when you first went
actually,
there?
Actually, no. What happened? So at Bowling Green, they had a Gamelan
okay.
there because there had
gotcha.
Been a woman who taught there. It's a funny story, actually. So then I got the interview at Florida State. I come here and they offered me the job the day of the interview, which I wasn't expecting because all the other interviews, it's like, you know, the last thing you do is you meet with the dean and they give you this whole spiel about, oh, here's our tenure and promotion thing and here's the real estate situation. And you're like, who cares? I don't know if I have the job. So, you know, this is like my fifth interview in 7 weeks. I've been all over the country. I'm dealing with all this stuff back, you know, home. And so then the dean, who at the time was John Pearsall, he says, and we've been delighted with your visit here, Michael, and, you know, we know you have other offers on the table, and we'd like you to join us here on the faculty of Florida State. And I was, like, spacing out, thinking about, I'm going to go to the beach tomorrow. And then I'm, like, you know, suddenly catch my attention, like, oh, you know, did you just offer me the job? And he's like, yeah, you know, again, we know, you know, we want you here, and you're our last candidate, and so we're not going to mess around. And so then I'm started, like, sort of trying to fill in the time as I'm trying to think, well, how do I respond to this? And I think, well, I'd have to blah, blah, blah. You know, just kidding, when you're sort of talking one thing and something else is going on in your head. And I just kind of blurted out, well, I guess I'd have to give up my gamelan because they had the gamelan at Bowling Green. And he just sort of jumped in and said, well, if we bought you a gamelan, would that make the difference?
Oh.
And then I swear, I'm 98% certain this was the next sentence. So I said, well, I'd still have to think about it, but that would certainly make a difference. And then he leaned forward and said, and what's a gamelan? So, and how much does it cost?
Right.
So, right. So anyway, that's how it happened. So actually, I was the one, you know, FSU purchased the gamelan and then sent me over there to commission the building of it. And that's a whole radio show in itself.
Right, right.
That was quite an experience, yeah.
And it is quite an experience to both see and hear
yeah.
the music, the gamelan music.
Yeah.
And it really is another world. I mean, as someone
yeah.
who plays quote-unquote Western music, but grew up in an Armenian culture too, Balinese music is so far afield from anything that I have ever really heard, both in
yeah.
the instrumentation and in the music theory itself.
That's right.
Can you, without, you know, I guess, like you said, a whole
without
book.
Writing written, another book about
without
it.
Writing another book
right,
about it.
Right, right.
Just for the listeners, what are some central themes of gamelan? What are some central themes of maybe Balinese music that
yeah.
that aren't so common or orthodox to the Western music that we know?
Sure, I can do that. So, I mean, the first thing you got to understand is that you're entering into a totally different sonic universe.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, 90% of the instruments are bronze percussion instruments.
Right.
So we have slab metallophones, kind of like, you know, like a xylophone or a vibraphone, but with bronze keys. And then we have all these different kinds of gongs, you know, from little tiny ones to great big ones that are like, you know, 90 inches across. And some of those gongs are set up on, you know, racks where they're played as melodic instruments, and others of them are punctuating instruments to mark out particular times within the cycles of the music.
Mm.
So we have this kind of shimmering quality of bronze that sort of permeates the whole space. Adding to that is the unique way in which these instruments are tuned. It's what we call paired tuning. So if we are tuning Western instruments, you know, you bring in your piano tuner, right?
Sure.
He's got his A440, he's got his
yeah.
pitchfork, and everything's kind of set up with the exact intervals. Well, in Bali, it's a quite different system. You have a male and a female version of every instrument.
Hmm.
And those t- two instruments, which are kind of thought of as one composite instrument, are tuned so that the pitch is a little bit apart. Now, when you get into the really low pitch ones, that would be like the equivalent of a semitone.
I was going to say it must be a semitone. Yeah, yeah.
But when they're struck together, they create this what's called ombak, a wave, an acoustical beating wave that goes whoa, 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 whoa.
Ah.
Now, the further up you go with these paired instruments into the high pitch ones, that difference goes from being a semitone to being a tiny microtone. But the way it's tuned is not to the specific frequencies, but rather to the rate of oscillation of that acoustical beating, of that ombak. So the tiniest instruments and the large instruments all vibrate at the same rate. So you have whoa, 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 whoa.
Right.
And the key art of the tuning is to figure out how close do we have to make the intervals on the little instruments and how big do we have to make on the big instruments so that that shimmering, that wave, that mechanical vibrato consumes the whole space. On top of that, as you go from octave to octave with the registers of the different instruments, the octaves are actually stretched. So if you're on a piano, you have an exact octave from, you know, C to C to C to C all the way up. Well, if you did that with a gamelan, this C would be, you know, a few cents higher than the C below it, and then that one a few cents.
Ah.
So that you get this stretching of the octave vertically and the stretching of the octave horizontally in the paired tuning. The idea behind all of that is that there's this sense, you know, if you do yoga or meditation, you know, Indian-based systems, Hindu-based systems, this is a Hindu culture in
right,
Bali.
Right,
most
Bali
of Indonesia is Muslim.
Right. Yeah, yeah, right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the idea is that, you know, like when you go Om, you know, the universal sound, the sound of creation, well, that every sound, you know, you've heard the old cliche that the entire universe is contained in a grain of sand, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's the same idea that the entire universe is contained within everything that exists within it.
Ah.
So that within every pitch, within every sonic event, every time a note is played, when the gamelan goes, bang, right, that is the whole universe right there. So by stretching out the octaves vertically and horizontally, we get that idea of an entire universe in every sonic event. Similarly, when the music is actually played, and especially more in the Javanese than in the Balinese style of gamelan,
interesting,
the articulation is intentionally out of time.
Oh.
So that when, you know, the different instruments are struck, quote unquote, you know, on the beat,
yep,
the big gong will come a little bit later than the small, you know,
kind
metal
of contrapuntal, yeah, if you will.
It's more like, not so much contrapuntal, but it's like, so you have counterpoint, you have,
yeah,
different melodies going on at the same time, but this is more like just a note. So like if we all had, like if an orchestra goes bomb, the Javanese especially would go bomb.
Oh, interesting.
And so it just,
okay,
sounds like, oh, these guys can't play together. You know,
right,
they're
right,
not
right,
very good ensemble. But
that's
actually
intended. That's
it's
the
intended,
yeah,
again, to stretch out the time so that every event is getting that whole sort of that cosmos within itself.
Right.
So those are a couple of things. And then,
yeah,
yeah, then the other thing that happens, you get these interlocking parts. So that in Balinese gamelan, all the melody parts, pretty much, at least once you get into the embellishment of the melody, rather than having one person play a melodic part, it's like two people are playing it, you know, Hocketing style.
Sure.
These guys got half the notes, this guy's got the other half notes. It's sort of the opposite of the Western concept. We're always trying to get, like, the drum set player, you know.
Yeah.
He's going to do the cymbal and the hi-hat and the bass drum and snare drum. You know, get one person to do what four used to do down,
yeah,
in New Orleans parade.
Right.
In Bali, it's the opposite. We can get three people to do what one person could do. That's better. Why? Because it creates tightness of the community.
Right, right. Interesting. It's very, very fascinating, and there are some parallels to other types of world music, and then,
sure,
some that have no parallel to me, at least in,
that's
my,
right,
sonically, for me hearing it when,
that's
I was,
right,
in Bali. It,
yeah,
really just took my breath away, and I can see how you could write several books on this.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, something that really blew me away, your textbook, World Music Traditions and Transformations, which was published by McGraw-Hill.
Mm.
It's been adopted in more than 150 universities and colleges nationwide and internationally.
Well, actually, it's up to 250
now.
Whoa!
Incredible. That is just, you should be so proud. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
deserved, but should be so proud. And there's, if I'm not mistaken, a third edition is coming out soon.
Yeah, the third edition will be out October 1st, according to all the records. And I'm very excited about third edition because in the first couple of editions, we've been kind of beholden to 20th century technology. There's been a CD set that accompanies the book.
Sure.
And so you have to license everything, right, and you can only have so much time on four CDs or whatever it is. Well, now in the third edition, McGraw-Hill has a contract with Spotify.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
I can use anything on Spotify. No more excerpts, no more choosing between this and that. So basically the music playlist has gone from 107 tracks on the second edition to 320 tracks on the third
edition.
So basically every time now that you come to a name, James Brown, Taylor Swift, whatever, sure. You just go boom and you click and there you've got it.
Wow.
And so that's been a kind of a revolutionary, liberatory experience for me as the author of a book, because I always wanted to be able to include all the music, but you couldn't get things. Like, you couldn't use Beyonce because they couldn't afford the licensing, or they couldn't get the license. And now it's if it's on Spotify. And the amazing thing was that all the stuff I had, like 95% of it, was already on Spotify.
As well as a good amount of world music. Because
including all the world music.
Yeah. Right, international. Right. It doesn't matter what country.
Everything's there.
Very, very few countries have a ban on something like Spotify.
That's right.
There are some. But even in Bali, going back to Bali really quickly, I was listening to Balinese pop bands.
Oh, yeah.
When I was there on Spotify.
Interviews
Absolutely. With them and things like that.
Yep.
I also want to talk to you about the Artism Project,
mm-hmm.
and both its connection to the center in Florida, as well as the book that you have coming. You have another book coming out that deals specifically with this.
Well, okay. There's no simple answers when you ask me questions.
Nice. That's okay. That's good.
I'll give you a quick sort of backstory to the new
please.
Book, which sort of encompasses the Artism Ensemble. Okay, so going back to 2003, here I was, sort of a mid-career ethnomusicologist, recently tenured, teaching in Florida State, had a couple of books out, another textbook, first edition, on its way, whatever. It's not that sort of. So, and then there was a sort of a total radical shift in my life when a kid came into my family network who, was diagnosed at about the age of 3 as being on the autism spectrum with mm-hmm. Asperger's syndrome. And so there's a close relationship I had with this kid, but I didn't really know how to kind of get in, because I didn't know what was going on because this was all new to me. And then I had my then colleague Ben Cohen, who used to teach at Florida State, he's now in China teaching at a university there. But he was over at the house for the first time. We were, just jamming, playing some drums after dinner. And this kid who, would always kind of, disappear whenever company came over or whatever, he emerged out of his bedroom and came while we were playing and just joined in with us.
Wow.
And it was just kind of this magical, amazing experience. And suddenly there was this kind of connection. And afterwards, this kid who would always kind of, wouldn't speak English even though he could and would kind of always carry a lot of tension in his body. Suddenly he was like relaxed and he was talking lucidly and he was using his, hands to gesture while he was speaking, just like a total change. And it was just like, this is what I got to do.
It was very obvious that the music had sparked something.
Music had done something, right. Mm. And so I just, somehow I have to create, what am I? I'm a musician. I'm an ethnomusicologist. Right. Somehow I have to make this what I, rather than going back to Bali or whatever else, I got to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I essentially found a way to create the ethnomusicology of autism. And that kind of, it was very strange initially for the field, but because I was already somewhat known, people were like, okay, we'll publish this stuff.
And specificity is very important in academia.
Right.
A true academician is very specific.
You gotta find the niche. And I had passion for it. So went there, and so first there was this project called the Music Play Project, which was kind of more therapeutic. Then a few years later, there was the Artism Project, where essentially it was almost like, these video games like Guitar Hero or something, where you had these kids on the autism spectrum. They would come in. We'd have this what we call the EWOMP, the Exploratory World Music Playground. We'd have all kinds of cool instruments all over the place, and they could just do whatever they want. But on top of that, we had a band of great musicians from all over the world, some of whom Dan, Carlos Odria, Carlos Silva, people like that.
Yeah, and, fantastic.
And, yeah, and so they were kind of there at the whim of these kids to sort of say, okay, you do this, you do that. And so we got this grant from the National Endowment of the Arts, and we put together this ensemble, and we went out and did, big concerts and, did, web broadcasts and all kinds of things. So that was Arts with Kids. And out of that, a whole bunch of interesting things happened. You can read about it if you want in the book when it comes out.
Nice.
But that kind of segued into this project where I was interviewing autistic musicians from all over the world, from Israel, from Canada, from all over the United States, and mainly interviewing them online, text messaging interviews, and you know, about their experiences as musicians living in the world as autistic people.
Amazing.
And those conversations become the basis of the new book, which is called Speaking for Ourselves: Conversations on Life, Music, and Autism. And I'm very fortunate and happy that the book has been accepted for publication by Oxford University Press.
Very nice.
And so it'll be out on June 1st. I'm very excited about
That's fantastic. On June 1st. And speaking of books, this is your fourth book, right?
Well, it depends how you count. I mean, you know, the main books, so there's Music of Death, New Creation, there's the World Music Textbook, and then there's this book. But because the World Music Textbook has been published in multiple
editions.
So we'll call it five.
Okay, fantastic. And then, okay, so that's coming out in 2018.
The third edition of World Music and the Autism book are coming out. Let me just qualify one thing before I go on, because some people, if they, you know, if they're in the world of therapy and so on, speech therapy, working with autistic people, might think, well, why is he saying autistic people? Why isn't he saying people with autism? Because there's sort of debate about the correct terminology.
Oh, really? Okay.
So there's what's called person-first language, where you say a person with autism, and that has become considered more respectful. However, people who are autistic, at least the people that I'm working with, they say, no, we don't like that. We are autistic people. Because if you say people with autism, it implies there's something bad about
right, that
autism.
It's a condition.
Yeah. It's like, you don't say you're a person with Armenianness.
Right, exactly. Right.
So just to qualify that.
Ah, it's very interesting. Yeah. Also, I wanted to touch on something that you have done for several years, I believe, at FSU, the Rainbow Concert.
Yeah.
And this is going into, it will be, 2018 will be the what?
21st, I believe.
Wow, I was going to say like 15.
Maybe even the 22nd, I'm losing track.
And you were involved in all of the, every single one of them?
Yeah, well, I was there, Dale Olson, who I talked about earlier.
Right.
He was my senior colleague until 2008 when he retired. And he still lives here in town.
He's
very much part of the community. Hey, Dale, if you're listening. he came up with, you know, they have this big thing, the PRISM concert. It's a big institution at FSU where it's like they bring out, you know, the marching chiefs, the big 400-piece marching band. They got all the orchestras and the choirs. And so Dale came up with this idea, well, why don't we do like a PRISM concert, but we'll do it world music with all of our world music ensembles? Because we have like the largest world music performance program in the country.
Arguably. I didn't know that.
Certainly in the southeastern United States. Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic.
You know, like 10, 11 ensembles going in all the time. And
wow.
So I was kind of, my first thought was, oh man, that sounds like a logistical nightmare, you know, it's just a lot of work. But you know, I was okay, you know, let's do it. So we did it, and then this tradition started of, you know, bringing in a guest artist every year. So this coming year, the 2018 concert, which will be on Friday, March the 2nd at Ruby Diamond Concert Hall, will feature a wonderful artist who you know also, Haechyung.
Haechyung,
who's
genius. She
genius.
Is absolute genius. I love playing with her. She's amazing musician.
So she's like you know, one of the world's greatest Chinese Zhong players.
Right.
Chinese is like the harp zither.
Yes.
And she actually won in 1995. She won the national Zhong competition of China. That's that's like winning the Leventritt piano competition.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so exactly.
She truly is world class. And she's now in her third year of her PhD. I'm her dissertation advisor. And she's off to China next year to do her field research for her dissertation. So this is going to be a big send-off for her.
Gotcha.
But we've been fortunate to have some really amazing guest artists, including yourself.
It was an honor. Myself and my boss, Mr. George Clinton.
Yes, indeed.
We got to do a P-Funk-themed rainbow concert where several of the ensembles played a different song from the vast discography of P-Funk's music. And it was an absolute pleasure. I had so much fun going in and rehearsing with the groups, meeting all the kids, the students, the adults, the professors, all the staff, all the people. Everyone was just so, so wonderful, and I know George really loved it too. And you also, I wanted to talk also about one of the ensembles that I've both seen before and after the Rainbow Concert several times and worked with, Omni Musica, which is your baby, basically.
Right.
And I know that are you on hiatus this semester? Or?
No, we're still active.
Okay.
But we will be I was on what's called research-oriented semester in the fall, so I was not teaching any of my regular classes, but I did do Omni Musica just for kicks and giggles, you know.
So tell everybody what Omni Musica exactly is and what you guys do.
So, you know, as per the theme of the conversation here, there's a bit of a backstory to it, how it happened in the first place. So going back to Artism, the Artism Ensemble, so around 2010, I kind of had these two ideas in my head. One of them was I wanted to, you know, figure out some kind of a new kind of an ensemble configuration to work with the autistic kids that we had been working with the Music Play Project, but in a more kind of performance environment, you know, to do concerts as opposed to just doing this kind of music play lab therapy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm not a music therapist, just that's another point to make here. And the other was to put together this kind of all-star ensemble, because we had all these incredible musicians here at Florida State, you know, who had come to study at the musicology or who were here for other reasons. Mia Gormandy, one of the world's great steel pan players, who just a couple days ago, you know, as per the day that we're doing this interview, graduated with her PhD.
Oh, nice.
And she's now professor of steel pan at the University of Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh, wow.
So she was in town, which is great. Fantastic. So anyway, we had all these great musicians, and so I thought, well, maybe we can put these things all together. So I put together this super group with those, you know, with Carlos Odria, Carlos Silva, Mia Gormandy, Vivian Astorizaga, all these great players.
Yeah.
And we started working with the kids. And then around that same time, the coordinator of musicology at the time, Douglas Seaton, my good friend and colleague, said, okay, you know, you've just been promoted to full professor and you've done a lot of good things around here. So next semester, I'm just going to give you, you know, rather than assigning you teach this or teach that, what do you want to teach?
Oh.
What do you want to teach? And so I said, you know what I want to teach? I'd like to teach like a practicum in cross-cultural improvisation and just bring together all these really good musicians we have around here from different cultures and see what we can cook up.
Incredible.
Yeah. And
fusion.
So, yeah, a fusion thing. So so we didn't really have any set design on. We brought all the people together and we just started. And, you know, and it turned from a cross-cultural improvisation thing more into a thing where myself and other members of the group were composing music,
right,
drawing from all these different traditions,
right,
and it sort of started to gel around this idea. Around that time, I was very interested in the Hebrew liturgy, Jewish prayers, traditional Jewish prayers, and so I started doing all of these settings of these traditional Jewish prayers, but in this world music fusion kind of, you know, crazy kind of vibe, and that became the basis of a semester or year-long project, which then became the basis of an album, which was put out and which actually ended up making it to the first ballot entry stage of the Grammys for Best World Music Album.
Ashray?
Ashray is the name of the album.
That's the album, right? Yeah, it's a fantastic album. And I was very happy to help
Mr.
David Cobb with some of the translating on an Armenian piece.
That's right. Which is how we first met.
I think it is too, yep. And since then, Michael and I have got to play in several ensembles, including Omni Musica and also my Armenian trio and my Armenian Dektet for the centennial of the Armenian genocide in 2015, and many other things. And it's interesting how the Omni Musica and ethnomusicology in general, but with Omni Musica almost specifically, it brings you back to that concert you spoke about, the fusion, the idea of a fusion of sounds from around the world. Because even Weather Report, where it's a jazz fusion group, they had at one time one of their drummers, Acuna, he's from Peru, right. Yeah. And so they were really incorporating this world thing into,
absolutely,
they had a percussionist who was also from Latin America somewhere,
yep,
and even Billy Cobham is from,
well, he's American, but he's like, because of working with John McLaughlin and Mahavishnu, he was one of the first great jazz drummers to really be incorporating all of these different
Brazilian things,
African things,
definitely
Indian things,
So it all kind of comes full circle.
It does.
And I want to ask you also, because I know personally your background, Jewish from Galicia, mm-hmm, which was at one point in Poland, one point the Austrian Empire, one point Ukraine.
What week it was
is in a different. So from the Jewish diaspora in Galicia, and how does that relate to how you feel about ethnomusicology as a whole?
Yeah.
And secondly, how far do you think ethnomusicology has gone from a point like, say, maybe even 20 years ago when you first started doing things with FSU?
Wow, well, those are two big questions. The Jewish question is an interesting one, maybe one I haven't thought about explicitly so much. But, you know, if you look at the field of ethnomusicology, of course, if you look at a lot of academic disciplines, there's a disproportionate representation of Jewish people who do this, you know.
Interesting.
Or the kind of the wandering Jew phenomenon.
Right,
because,
right.
You know, we're going all over the world. And for a long time, I think a lot of those people were... you know, they were studying Balinese music, or they were studying West African music, or they were studying, you know, whatever. Then in more recent years, there was more of a sense of some of these Jewish scholars coming back to saying, well, what about me? What about my ethnicity? What about my tradition? What about my being Jewish?
Right.
And so you have people like Mark Sloban and Kay Chalamet and Judah Cohen, other, you know, lots of Joel Rubin, more than I can mention, who deserve to be mentioned in this, Mark Kligman, who are ethnomusicologists who are studying Jewish music from an ethnomusicological perspective.
Right.
And I guess in my case, I've done some of that. I wrote one of the chapters in the first edition of my world music book was on music and Jewish mysticism, and, mm-hmm. and that was something I was, you know, Kabbalah, and I was very interested in that.
Yeah.
But for me, it's actually been more, the Jewish connection has been more in my musical life.
Hmm.
So there's the Ashrei project of the setting of those prayers, and then there's this whole other thing which you know, you and I have kind of played with in different ways, which is my kind of numerological, mathematical, permutational, combinational side of things. And that actually ties in some interesting ways, probably beyond what we have time to talk about today, into sort of Kabbalistic gematria of the numerological systems. And I've written some, one major gamelan piece called Gending Berwang, which means Song of the Bear. There's a weird story behind that where there was like a Winnie the Pooh bear and you push its stomach and it sings a song and that's the theme.
Okay.
But anyway, but it was all based on all of this kind of, you know, Kabbalistic numerology. And I actually ended up giving a talk at the University of Chicago, which was a really whacked talk in which I got up. They had invited me. It was after my first book on Gamelan came out. I think they thought I was going to talk, you know, about something like that. And then I got up and talked about that piece, Gending Berwang. But I actually interviewed myself as I was like the ethnomusicologist interviewing the composer of the piece.
Hmm.
So it was kind of this, you know, this very bizarre thing.
Wow.
And talking about the process and the kind of the numerological foundations of this piece and the mathematics of it. And you know... the people in the audience, like, some people really dug it, and then, like, some of the people, like, what the heck is this guy coming up to the University of Chicago? Talk? But the coolest thing was there was this very, very eminent music theorist, Professor Cohn, and he had just showed up, you know? And then afterwards, he, you know, I'm saying, any questions, and some people ask me, this guy's sitting in the back and raises his hands. I didn't know who he was. You know, I would have known if I had known his name, but I didn't. He was just sitting there, and he starts asking me, so when you were talking about the permutational combinations of the cycle of 27 and the cycle of 40 and how they, you know, add up to 1,080, but, you know, if you double up, and like he was going way beyond
because he's paying
attention. his whole thing is like, you know, mathematical music theory, and it, for me, that was like this unbelievable moment. Like I just felt like the angels were entering my soul or something, where mm-hmm. this guy had gotten the piece in a way like nobody else ever could, you
know.
It's
fantastic.
And so yeah, there's definitely that sort of Jewish imprint through Kabbalistic thinking, but, you know, maybe going back generation, things that are sort of in
my DNA. I was
going to
say, yeah,
you know?
Imprinted in you. Yeah, yeah.
Now, as far as
that's the best stuff anyway.
It, sometimes, indeed.
Yeah.
As far as how ethnomusicology has changed, it's changed tremendously, and I've been really happy that it has, because when I first came into the field, I was actually very bitter to be there because I'd mentioned earlier I had this chronic pain syndrome which caused me to stop being able to play.
Right.
And that's when I went to graduate school, but I kind of came in the back door. This wasn't my choice of what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a player, you know,
right.
I wanted to be a composer, I wanted to be a musician. And here I, you know, sort of as a second option, I was being an ethnomusicologist. Now that changed over time. Now I couldn't be happier with what I do. But at the time I was this angry graduate student, very bitter. And what made me really mad was that at that time, it was all kind of this, you know, structural anthropology approach, and everything was very kind of sciencing about music, to quote Alan Merriam, who was a very famous ethnomusicologist of the 1960s. And to me, what it felt like was, you know, like the way that they were thinking and talking and treating music was, You know, like if you someone you loved had just died and they put up an anatomically correct portrait of that person on the wall, you know, like and then had a pointer and said, so this was Pat, and this was Pat's arm, and this was right. Pat's hand, and this was how she used her hand to. But that doesn't tell you anything about. And I felt that the way that they were talking about music and musicians was kind of like that. And I became kind of ornery about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, over time, the field shifted and this what I figured out early on kind of intuitively was that there's not enough attention to actual musicians, what they have to say, what they care about, what they feel in the music. And the other thing is the reason that those people aren't in there is because the scholars themselves are taking themselves out of the story. They're trying to be these, you know, these objective scientists. Yeah. So if you don't have the person who's doing the interviewing, the research, whatever, then you can't have the person on the other side. How would this conversation go if you weren't asking me these questions? It wouldn't make any sense.
Right, right.
So I sort of figured out it has to be about dialogue. It has to be about dialogue in music making and dialogue in conversation.
Mm.
And until we put that back in, it's not weird. Now, there were some people who were sort of saying that before I came along. But when I came along is right about the time it started to really kick in. And just by good chance, the guy who became my major professor, my dissertation advisor, Tim Rice, eminent ethnomusicologist at UCLA, just retired, he kind of came from that more science side to where I was at. And I came from, you know, this kind of whacked out musician side, and we kind of met in the middle. And interestingly, our two first books are often kind of taught together because they kind of both deal with this idea. So what it came to involve is this idea of reflexivity, the scholar sort of engaging his or her own experience within whatever happened in Bali, in Bulgaria, in his case, wherever it was. And as good fortune would have it for me, that was all considered, you know, I was considered like way out in left field doing all this stuff. And my fellow students at UCLA are like, what the heck? You can't do that. But right at the very year that my dissertation came out, this giant 609-page tome on, you know, reflexive ethnomusicology of Balinese, you know, gamelan, this guy Tim Rice and some other sort of heavy hitters of the, you know, the prior generation did this big panel at the big ethnomusicology meeting on reflexivity. And so suddenly that was what everybody was talking about. And here I came onto the job market on the cutting edge of it. And so I went from sort of this outlier, outcast guy who, you know, everybody figured, oh, you know, he's kind of smart, but he's kind of crazy and, you know, he's never going to get a job, to, you know, being able to entertain lots of job offers. So the moral of that story is stick to your convictions, do what you think is right, and eventually, hopefully, you'll get a job.
That is fantastic. Now, Michael, I know you have a bunch of shows coming up in January. Can you tell us maybe just what the next three or four are that you have coming up?
Sure. I can kind of, hopefully I can remember everything. So January 6th, I will be at the Blue Tavern with the Back in Market Hall World Trio, which is an amazing group. The young pianist, Mason Margot, he's currently in a senior year at jazz studies major at Florida State, studying with Marcus Roberts and Bill Peterson.
Nice.
And those guys.
Very cool.
And he's really, you know, he's on his way.
Yeah.
He's going to be going to New York next year.
And
we'll be able to say, you know, we knew him when.
Nice.
And then the great bassist in town, Brian Hall, who, you know, he's kind of like my brother here. So we'll be playing there on the 6th. And then on the 12th, I'll be back at Blue Tavern with Brian again and with great jazz guitarist Richie Suma. And then on the 18th, it's like every 6 days, it's almost like a Kabbalistic. I'll be actually there again with Colleen Nixon, who's this wonderful, wonderful singer. And then on the 19th, I'll be down at Rio Carabel. They have a nice jazz series down on Carabel, down on the coast there.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
With the Back and Margaret Hall Trio. And then on the 20th, before the Tallahassee Symphony Concert from 6:30 to about 7:45, we'll be playing in the lobby as the sort of the pre-show before the symphony concert with Back and Margaret Hall. So
nice.
A few things coming up.
I highly urge everybody to come out and see all, if you can, of these performances. at least one or two with Professor Michael Back. And Professor Michael, it has been endlessly fascinating as always. I could talk to you for hours about all of this stuff and many other things. Congratulations on your continued success, and we hope we can have you come back and talk to us some more soon in the future.
Absolutely. I'll come back anytime. And if this is your first time being the interviewer as opposed to interviewee, you're a natural.
Hey!
You did an awesome job.
Nice.
It's been a pleasure. It's been really fun.
Professor Michael Backen, and we'll be right back. Thank you very much. Been a fantastic first show, I think. We had a great time. I'd like to thank again Professor Michael Bakken for coming on the show. Danny on everything, and I have to give a shout out to Miss LaShonda Clinton Drennan, my dear friend and longtime bandmate in P-Funk and in other bands as well. She came up with the name years ago. People used to always say, Danny, you got to have a show. You got to have some kind of show where you just talk about, well, just everything. You know what I mean? Because in addition, a lot of people know me for the P-Funk thing. A lot of people know me for the keyboard thing, piano thing. My friends and co-workers know that I am something of a Renaissance man. And I'm really interested in everything. I like history. I went to school for history. I graduated and a historian of Middle Eastern studies from the University of New Hampshire, and have taken a real interest in everything from ancient Middle Eastern history to modern genetics and how it relates to ADNA, which is ancient DNA. And I'm real also very interested in things like comedy. I have a number of friends in the comedy world. I myself have flirted with it here and there. So you're going to hear some of my Danco commercials as we go through the show, the various shows as we go on. I'm a big fan of comic books, and I've been quietly finishing my first comic book as well, under my publishing company, and the book is called Sons of the Sun. We're going to talk about that in the coming months as that gets finished up. We're going to have a lot of my friends on, bandmates from P-Funk, other musicians that I know, talking about not just music, but things like politics and culture and movies and, like I said, comic books and entertainment. And I also have a deep love for poetry and have a lot of really good friends who are some of the most fantastic living poets that are around from up in New York. I got to have those guys on, and we're going to be doing a whole little section on poetry and literature that we're swapping back and forth. But it's really something I'm very passionate about, doing this show. And I've just been thinking about doing something like this for such a long time. It feels really, really good and therapeutic to be able to finally broadcast to all of you out there and talk to you about everything. So it's my absolute pleasure. We're looking forward to doing more of these. Thank you to everybody at the Moose, the Cerny family. Thank you to Professor Michael Backen for coming on. And we are signing off for now. This is Danny Bedrosian, Danny on everything. We'll talk to you next time.